it again. I'd like to rectify it. I did not tell the joke about, is that all you've got to give? Right. So bear with me while I try to say it proper this time. There was an ad on TV. A woman was conducting the ad, and she was working for a very large company in the USA that made generators that, you know, give you light and all that when all the lights are out because of storms and other things. And they had made this generator that would be able to handle anything and everything that might happen, such as tornadoes and hurricanes and all that. And so she was standing outside and pumped her fist in the air and said to God, "Is that all you've got to give? Meaning, I got this generator and it can outdo you." But that's not really the way it goes when... And that shows the arrogance of Israel and the arrogance sometimes of human beings that they can even outdo God. But when you've been through a hurricane, not moving forward, but in circular fashion, it was going 200 miles an hour, it's just a scream. And that was one of those that Delia and I experienced, not in the middle of it, but at least close by. 200 miles an hour, and it's just a scream. I don't think a generator is going to overdo that at all. Just thought I would rectify the explanation. Excuse me just a moment. Some years ago, quite a few years ago now, the late Nobel Prize winning Albert Schweitzer was being interviewed in London, and a reporter asked him this question. Doctor, what's wrong with men today? Schweitzer thought for a good while. He was silent. And then he said very quietly and simply, but firmly, men simply don't think. Now, that's quite an accusation from a man about men, but he spoke it sincerely and firmly when asked the question, what's wrong with men today? You might say, well, what do you mean, what's wrong with men? They don't think? Men don't think? My mind is filled, they would say, with thousands of things every day, so how in the world could you say men don't think? So many things are pushed at me all day long, every day. Well, that's just the point, and I don't think we realize that sometimes. The average American men are so rushed, so pressured, so harried, every day, day after day, that there's little or no time to think definitively. I add the word definitively. And think about that. For instance, the typical day of the average American male, shall we say, women too, but maybe not as much as men. The night before the next day, the evening news is filled with bad news of the world today, and they fill their mind with that. The evening meal, they're tired, or they rush through or gulp through the meal, and the next morning for breakfast, they are rushed through the meal. Then they come home, and there's little time to do anything because they've been so rushed all day long. They may watch a football game, a basketball game, or a TV movie, murder or the murder mystery or something like that. They may watch Dancing with the Stars. They may watch the good things that take the pressure off them. Then they fall in bed late. Even then, maybe watching a show from the bedtime. And then they're up early in the next morning, they grab a bite to eat, rush to work, and they're busy all day with the things that are placed before their eyes that they have to react to. And most of it is not of their choosing at all, but it fills their day, day after day, and every day they come home worn out, enervated, and it's repeated day after day after day. Now, we don't do that, do we? Maybe we don't. I hope we don't. Some do, depending on the circumstances. But it is quite common in the USA and other parts of the world where their day is so filled, they do not have time to think, and they are enervated when they come home, and they don't, or they think, they say, I don't have time to think. I've got to get rid of all of this frustration by watching something on TV, and that takes away an hour, 2 or 3 hours, and they don't have time to think. So in some ways, it is true that men don't think. Big part of it, the reason why, is they don't have time to think, and I say definitively. The daily routine of many, maybe the average, maybe the most of Americans, American men, does not have moments of time penciled in to their schedule for thinking. It isn't. I don't think the average man has penciled into his daily schedule a time to think. That is, to focus on a particular topic. They pencil into their daily schedule time for many activities, but few deliberately pencil in definite time for deliberate, focused thinking. Why do I say that? Because if you've ever gone to the bookstore and looked at the shelf for self-help books, you will find book after book after book and tape after tape after tape, DVD after DVD, stressing self-improvement through using the mind in a focused way. Why do they do that? Because they know the average person isn't doing that, and they're making money selling books teaching them how to do that, to focus their mind in order to improve their life. I've mentioned the man Earl Nightingale before. He was one of the first and foremost in cassette tape albums on leading the field. And he advocated very firmly and forcefully devoting a certain amount of time with paper and pencil every day, or at least 5 days a week, listing many ideas on how to do things, how to do a better job, how to succeed in your chosen field, how to live your life better, and have time to improve whatever it is that you're having trouble with, which is with most of us. We're having trouble with certain things. How do we solve that? Nightingale advocated taking a pencil and a clean sheet of paper and writing at the top of the page, "My goal is," or, which is often the case, "My problem is," or, "My purpose is," and then listing as many ideas as will come to your mind, and that may be difficult at times, but to list as many ideas as you can think of in order to accomplish your stated goal, task, or problem. In other words, learn to think definitively. Learn to focus your mind when thinking about a problem of how to solve it and how to improve your life. As Christians, we are admonished, and I use the word admonished, not just suggested. We are admonished in the Bible to learn this focused thinking. But, and I've said this quite a few times before, it's couched in such religious terminology that we usually miss the point. And it's just something in the Bible. And we totally ignore the biblical recommendations. Let's look at one of these admonitions, and we've read it many times, but from this perspective about definitive thinking, for the purpose of improving the problem, of solving the difficulty, and of being able to live better. Look at it from that perspective in Joshua 1, and we'll begin in verse 1, but skim down through the first 8 verses. Joshua chapter 1, this is the story of the death of Moses, and what God had to say to Joshua. Joshua 1 and verse 1, after the death of Moses, the one who was the servant of God, came to pass that God spoke to Joshua, who was the assistant to Moses. Now, assistants have good jobs. I won't say they have a cushy job, but they don't have to take the pressure. They don't have to make the decisions. They don't have the trauma that the leader, in this case Moses, had. You don't find Joshua losing his cool like Moses did when the Israelites got him. They jabbed him one time too many and too hard, and he flew off the handle, and he lost his opportunity to go to the promised land. And God said, you know, you're going to be in the family, but you're not going to the promised land physically. He said to Joshua, Moses is dead. So now the assistant had to step up to be the leader. He had to make the decisions. He had to make the choices. He had to have the answers. And he had also to take the criticism, which none like to do. So God was instructing Joshua that you're no longer the assistant. You're now the leader, and there are certain things that you will have to do. It's easy to follow a being of strong personality. Herbert Armstrong was one of those. And it was easy to follow Herbert Armstrong because you didn't have to wonder what he meant when he said it. And he would make the decision. As I've said, he said many times, I will settle this right now. And he did, at least on the surface, because he had a strong personality. In verse 7, you will find that God said to Joshua, let's start in verse 6, be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to the fathers. Not going to be Moses anymore, it's going to be you. Only be strong and very courageous that you may observe to do according to all the law. And what's the law? It's a principle, it's a guideline, it's an answer of how to solve certain things. If you don't want to get in trouble, don't tell lies. You won't have to make up another lie to cover the first. You don't want to have to go to prison, don't steal. You don't want to ruin your marriage, don't commit adultery. So guidelines are given in the law, and the guidelines guide our life. Then in verse, and I call the law a principle, although it is not just a principle, it is God's law, because the law sounds very religious, but a principle sounds like common sense, the natural thing you ought to do. He said in verse 8 that he was to use it as a guideline, it was not to depart from his mouth. And then verse 8, the middle of the verse, it says, but you shall, and here comes that word that tells us about definitive thinking in order to learn how to solve things. You shall meditate. Now, when you think of, well, maybe not so much now, but before you were in the Church of God, if you ever heard the word meditate, what was your first reaction? Was it a guru sitting with his legs crossed and chanting some mantra over and over again till he passes out? That was meditation. We think meditation is some strange, weird act that we perform. But meditation is nothing more than thinking definitively on a subject. And you don't have to cross your legs to do that. You can sit back with a cup of coffee and do it. But it means to think about what you need to do. And as I said, if we use the law of God as a guide, then we can say, well, now do I want to tell this lie? If I do, then I'm going to have to make up another one to cover this. Do I want to steal this item from the company? If I do, what will I do if I get caught? Do I want to have an affair with this individual? If I do and I get caught, what's it going to do to my marriage? And on you can go with the Ten Commandments about that. The principles of life. There are principles that guide our life. So God told Joshua, you need to meditate on these things. And notice it said, not just ever so often, whenever it's convenient, but you shall meditate on it all the time, day and night, so that you may observe to do according to all that's written in it. Then you'll have a prosperous way, and you'll have good success. If you meditate on the principles of life and then make that decision that will help you to follow that principle. In the old King James, the word is meditate. Fortunately, it still says that in the new King James. The word for meditate is a primitive root word, and it means to murmur. Now, it doesn't mean to mutter. You can murmur and still think and talk very clearly. Murmur means thinking, talking, expressing, learning, doing. It means to murmur either in pleasure or anger. By implication, it means to ponder, to imagine, to meditate, to speak, to study, to talk. In this case, talk to yourself. Now, usually if we find someone talking to themselves, we think we need to send them to the funny farm. But we should learn to talk to ourselves in the sense that we are talking. Not that you're speaking the words verbally outwardly, but your mind is telling your mind, I ought to do this. And if I don't, this is what I've got to face. If I do, this is what I'll receive. Talking to oneself, meditating, thinking, definitive thinking. As the man said, men don't think. Quite often we think, I'll solve this problem with my fist. I'll solve this problem with my gun. I'll solve this problem with my machoism. Maybe, maybe not. But thinking, definitive thinking, will often, if not always, make a huge difference in the way our life goes. But as said, the average person says, I don't have the time to do that. I don't have the time to do that. I'm so worn out when I come home, I can't even think. That's true. And so what do? They watch TV that puts more mindlessness in their mind. Not that what they watch would be evil as such, but it's not probably going to help solve the problem. It just takes away from one the time in their schedule, daily schedule, that they could have used in thinking, meditating. How many people do you know that do this deliberately? Maybe you don't have to raise your hand. Maybe you do know some. The average person doesn't. How do you know those who set aside penciled time and deliberately focus on whatever the subject is? As I said, unfortunately, we often equate meditation with some sort of religious ritual. Go to the cave. Go to the mountain. They always have to get up to this high mountain and then seek God. Or sit under the tree until the apple hits you on the head and puts some sense in your brain. If I walk up to you and I said, you know, it's obvious in knowing you all these years and looking at you to see how you operate, you need to meditate more. You probably would say, nope, I don't want that. That's religion. But what if I walked up to you and I said, look, it's obvious after knowing you all these years and seeing the troubles that you've been in, I think you need to focus your thinking on your problem in order to see how to solve it. You'd probably say, you're right, I do. And yet, though the sentences verbally have different words, the meaning is exactly the same, that we need to focus on our problem to see how to deal with it. Definitive thinking. There is no difference. Meditation is focused thinking, true meditation. The other is simply focused thinking of and by itself. They both mean the same. One seems religious, the other is common sense. I think that meditation, focused thinking, is one of the most profitable and truly logical things that a Christian man or woman could ever do to improve his or her life and lifestyle. To reiterate it again, meditation is focusing in or on a particular subject, using your mind to analyze it from all directions, top, bottom, left, right, over and around, in order to see it in all of its totality, and then trying to see how it can be applied to your Christian life in order to improve. That's definitive thinking. That's true meditation. In other words, meditation, focused thinking, is learning how to grow in the grace and knowledge, the gracious ways of God the Father and Jesus Christ, our older brother and Savior. We're trying to learn how to act, not react, but act and make choices in order to please God the Father and Jesus Christ and to improve our life. The Bible, the law of God, is merely a beginning point, a point of reference, and a framework for doing that. As I said before, the law of God says, don't kill. What if you knew you could kill and get away with it? Should you do it anyway? You may have to sit down and think about it, or steal something, or lie on your federal income tax. Obama's not going to get my money. I'm not going to tell him the truth. I'm going to keep it for me. Well, I would agree with you, humanly speaking. It irks me to give it to them too. But there was a man here in the Columbus area the last time we were here, not 2 weeks ago, but you know, years ago when we were here, he refused to pay income taxes. I talked with him about it. I warned him about not doing that, but he didn't listen. He wouldn't. He said it's not the right thing to have to pay taxes like that. That's against the plan. That's against what the founding fathers had said. So he went ahead and did what he had in mind, and he wound up in prison. I don't know if he ever got out, but he had to pay the consequences because he didn't think it through from all directions. The law of God is summarized by the principle of love. Love to one person is one thing. Love to another person is another thing. Love to some is being kind and generous and thoughtful and helpful. And love to the other is sexual intercourse prior to marriage or during marriage with someone other than your wife. Love can mean a lot of things. So if you're thinking about love definitively, you need to think a lot. It's broken down into two areas, one toward God. How can we love God? The word can mean idolize. Would it be blasphemy to idolize God? No, it wouldn't. Would it be blasphemy to adore God? That's a strong word to say that you adore someone or something. To say that you adore God and you love him so much, he is your adoration, and you idolize him. It's also divided into love for a human being. Now, it didn't say, and it's a good thing that you have to like all men, but it did say you need to learn to love people as if they were yourself. I think there's just a little bit of difference there. You can not like them, but you better not love them, because they're made in the image of God. They're his creation, not ours. And they will have the chance to be in the family of God someday. So we need to love God with all our heart and love man as if he were ourselves. And then, of course, it has the Ten Commandments. As I said, you can go down to each one and meditate on each one of those and ask yourself, how does this apply to me? What if I don't do it? Can I afford to take the consequences? What are the good things that come if I do live by it? Would I like that? Sure. Anyone who would say no would be a fool. And of course, it then also has statutes, civil statutes, and judgments of the individuals who were in the seat of judgment. The law of God is an absolute conclusion from the mind of God. It is the way that God thinks. And we all say we want to be like God and think like God. But how often do we think about analyzing the mind of God that's expressed through his laws? We are analyzing God's mind. It sounds like blasphemy to say, I'm analyzing God's mind. Yes, if you're studying the Ten Commandments, because that's the way he thinks. We have to fill our mind with God's laws if we're going to be like God. So we have to think about what do we need to fill our mind with. Often what we see in this society is how to beat the other man. Not how to help the other man make a living also, but how to beat him. We will never beat anybody out of the kingdom of God. The only one to do that is themselves when they give up and quit and tell God to get out of their life. But we'll never beat them. We can't. It's not our prerogative. As I said, we think of meditation as religion, and we don't want any more religion. Quite often, though, it will take and does take, and it has to happen. We sometimes think of tragedies and we think, well, why did God allow that or why did God do that? Because we always want to blame God. It often takes a tragedy to change our mind about thinking and analyzing and learning to think definitively and to get rid of the things that are wrong or would be wrong in our lives. But on the other hand, to have to wait and let a calamity do that is not the best. And the Bible also talks about that. If you look in Job 1, and I won't read the whole thing, but just to give you a summary of it, in Job chapter 1, beginning in verse 13, Job was a very financially sound individual. He was a leader in his community. In his troubles, he said, I used to take care of the widows. When I came around, people were awed by me, but now I'm just scrubbing myself on this pile of dirt and things that are hurting my skin and my body and my life. I'm nobody. Nobody cares about me or asks me of my wisdom and judgment. Little selfish, little pity party kind of like, you know. So in Job 1, you will find in his heyday, here's what happened. Job 1 and verse 13 says, there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking. Now, it doesn't say they were debauching themselves. It doesn't say it was an ugly party of delinquents. But apparently they weren't doing it totally right. They were eating and drinking in their oldest brother's house, and it says a messenger came and told Job the ox were plowing, and you'll find that he says they all were killed, and I'm the only one that's left to tell you what happened. And while he was talking, another came and said essentially the same thing about the the fire from God fell from heaven, and he consumed them, and I'm the only one left to tell you. And while he was talking, another one said, the Chaldeans came, and they killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I'm the only one left to tell you. While he was speaking, another one came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking, and a great wind, which of course comes from God in control of the universe, came across the wilderness, struck the corners of the house, it fell on them, they're all dead, I'm the only one. Now, you'll initially find that Job had a good attitude here. He said, it says, he arose, took his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground and worshiped God and said, well, I came naked from my mother's womb and I guess I'll return naked. You win some, you lose some. Blessed be the name of God. A really positive attitude. But it says in this, Job did not sin or charge God with any wrong. But let's skip over to chapter 3 and verse 1. Somewhere along the line, it seems that Job changed. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Now, if you're happy with everything, why would you want to curse the day you're born? Because, you know, if you wish, and I know sometimes we do think, I wish I'd never been born. That's a foolish statement, because if we had never been born, we wouldn't have the opportunity to be in the family of God, which would be an incredibly awful thing to happen, not to have the chance to be in the family of God. And he was cursing the day that he was born. May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived. May that be darkness. May God not seek it. And then, let's see, coming down to verse 23, he said, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? So he's blaming God now. And that's what usually we do. Instead of thinking about it in a focused way, in a definitive way, trying to find out truly what is true, why did this happen? If indeed we can. And why are we where we are with the troubles that we have? Whom God has hedged in. He began to ask some questions. Now, you will find that God felt that Job still was a friend, and he did not allow Satan to destroy him. And Job learned, and once he changed, you will find that God gave him twice what he had before. So we're not talking about God trying to kill somebody or corrupt somebody or destroy somebody or confuse someone. Now let's go to another one that talks about this tragedy. Because sometimes it does take a tragedy to cause us to begin to think about these things. Up until that, it's something we just put off onto the backside. But once a tragedy has happened, why did it happen? Usually, as I said, we blame God. They blame God for the hurricanes that happened. Well, God could stop it, but it's not his world. This is Satan's world. Let's go to Psalm 119, beginning in verse 9, where David, or the psalmist, is talking about life and how to clean it up and how to make sure it works. Psalm 119 and verse 119, he asks a penetrating question, and it is directed toward young people in general, because sometimes the young person who has no experience thinks that no wrong can ever happen. You just go on and on and on and always do good. Have a good job, make a good income, have a good house, find a good wife, And it just goes right on into when he's dead and everything is hunky-dory. But it says, how can a young man cleanse his way? And we are hearing more and more and more of the young people today whose ways are not cleansed. They are perverting themselves. They are destroying themselves. And nobody seems to understand why. He said, how can a young man cleanse his way? And the answer is by taking heed according to your word. Well, words, in this case, biblical words, are principles of life. And what he was advised to do is to take notice of the words from the Bible that could change his life. In other words, think according to the word of God. Then he said in verse 10, with my whole heart have I sought you. So he was thinking about it all the time. And then he asked God. And this is another thing to put down when we are trying to reason with ourselves and think definitively. One of them may be, maybe I should ask God. Maybe I just should ask God to be in my life. He said to God, let me not wander from your commandments. Some look at some of the commandments, think, well, that's not so bad. I mean, it's not hurting too many more people. And if it is, it's not hurting them all that bad. But he was told, let me not wander from your commandments. Your word I've hidden in my heart. And then verse 15, it says, in answer to how shall a man do this? I will, and here comes that word again, that very religious word, which is the answer to problems. I will meditate on your precepts. And of course, precepts are the principles of life that would guide our life. Meditate meaning I will definitively think on your precepts. Get out a fresh sheet of paper, write down the problem. What principles do I need to incorporate in order to solve this problem? I will meditate or definitively think on this problem. And then he said, I will delight myself in your statutes. Delight is a good word. To be delighted. If someone said, well, I know you got problems. I'll give you a couple of $100,000 and maybe so. You'd probably be delighted. But if someone just gave us ideas that would truly save our life, would we be delighted? Probably not as much as if they gave us $200,000. I will not forget your word, he said. And then in verse 18, a very, very important point. As I said, sometimes we have to ask God. I don't seem to be able to see this. I can't seem to figure it out. I'm not going anywhere. I'm just spinning my wheels. David, the psalmist, whoever the psalmist was at this time, said, would you open my eyes? Open my eyes. And we know that's just an analogy. We got our eyes open all the time. We're still dumb. But it means there's sometimes we just don't see it. And somehow we can't seem to see it. Have you heard of the, and I know you have, the aha principle? You've been studying something and it just won't come across, you can't get it, can't see it, nothing happens. And finally, it leaps out at you from the page, hits you in the face, and you say, aha, I got it now. That's a key point. Asking God to open our eyes so that we can see. It's called the aha principle. It's gone over our heads day after day. Week after week, year after year. But now it jumps off the page and hits us right in the face. It may take that, asking God, please show me. Now, of course, we also have to realize that once we've asked God and He does show us, then we have to be humble enough to accept it and use it. In verse 53, it says, indignation has taken hold of me because of the wicked who forsake your law. Again, as we analyze the Ten Commandments and look at each one and say, now what would happen to me if I tell a lie? What would happen to me if I commit adultery? What would happen to me if I kill a person? What would happen to me if? We know the answer. Do we want that answer? Do we want that result? Well, we're foolish if we do. But then analyze it from the other viewpoint. Here's what would happen to me if I do live by that principle. Would you like that? Again, only the fool would say, no, I don't care for that at all. I want to be in trouble all my life. He said, indignation. He got upset over the difficulties that the wicked had to take because they just won't live by God's laws. Now, I've said this many times, and the Bible says it. Paul said about the Jews, are they any better? And he said, absolutely not. But they are better off because they know God's law. And so we're no better than the wicked, but we don't have to try to figure out an answer to cover the false answer we gave. And we would have that blessing because we thought it through. In verse 59, he says, I thought, shall we say meditated? I thought. Now, Schweitzer said, men don't think. But this psalmist said, I thought about my ways. And afterward, I turned my feet, or lived another way, I turned my feet to your testimonies. I made haste and didn't delay to keep the commandments. Then in verse 97. Sometimes we think that after definitive thinking, we find the answer and we know we got to live by it, but we're not happy because we didn't want to do that. And though we solved the problem categorically, we still have to deal with our attitude. The psalmist said, oh, how I love your law. I think about that all day long. I meditate about that all day long. I think definitively about that all day long. Then in verse 99, he said, I have more understanding than all my teachers because your testimonies are my meditation. Again, he thought about the principles of life. He didn't have experience, but he used what God said, and he had a better life than the others who were his teachers. I don't want to sound like I'm bragging by saying the things I'm going to say about some things in my life that have helped me along this line, because I didn't, in a sense, volunteer for all of this. I was kind of asked to be a part of it, and it's been a wonderful blessing in learning to think critically, because as many of you know, I'm a slow-moving Texan. And I've had to learn certain things that you Yankees already knowed, if I can put it that way. In the last few years, there have been several review groups in the United Church of God that is reviewing certain things that we teach. And I was selected, not that I volunteered, but I was selected to be a part of them. And this has helped my ability to critique or to use critical thinking skills in a positive way, or to analyze things from the top and the bottom, or to meditate on Is this true? Is this the way it should be done? What shall we do? What rules do we follow? And it's been for my good and for the good of others in the Church of God. One was, and I don't remember how far back this goes, somewhat after 95 when United was just beginning, you probably have the booklet, The Fundamental Beliefs of the United Church of God. That didn't just happen like that. That was produced over a long period of time by 20 different individuals, ministers in the United Church of God. Each minister who volunteered to produce one of the beliefs or was asked to produce one of them, as a tape that we had at this time, not a video, had to write up his message and submit it to six of the other ministers on the review committee. Then we had to review it. We had to offer suggestions, and then we sent it back. And when it finally passed the review of the seven, when we had properly expressed our basic belief, we sent it back to the individual, and then he gave it as a sermon in his local church. And when it finally passed review, it was sent to Home Office to put together in the booklet The Fundamental Beliefs of the United Church of God. And I can't remember which one I did critique and helped, but it helped me in learning to think critically and analytically over the whole thing, and has been a help in my life in meditating, shall we say, thinking definitively. The second one, and I've mentioned this, and I don't want to belabor this, but it's has been a big part of the ministry of my life the last 12 to 14 years, divorce and remarriage. I didn't volunteer. I was volunteered, and there are three senior ministers, and they have to have about 25 years of experience in the ministry. And we then review cases sent in from members in the Church of God who say they want to know where they stand before God as far as the divorce or the remarriage. And sometimes they've already got another couple lined up to get married very shortly after that, even before we have reviewed it. We have to review it and see how it coincides with God's law. If it does, fine. If it doesn't, well, we have another problem. So this has helped me tremendously in learning how to focus my mind and to think definitively or to meditate on certain things as to how to solve the problem. Now, the third one was, and you may not have even known that we have this in the United Church of God because it hasn't been used much and it's kind of in limbo right now. Nobody's asking to appeal their decision, but you may or may not have heard of the EEAC Committee in the United Church of God, the Expelled Elders Appeal Committee. Elders who had been expelled from the ministry because of whatever, and they appealed. They said, I don't like that. I don't agree with that. I appeal. Well, it was sent to the EEAC Committee, and we had to look at all sides and decide whether or not they had anything, if they really were right. Maybe they had been misused. Maybe they hadn't. In the 90, I think it started about 98, 99, maybe even to 2010, upwards of 50 ministers, pastors, resigned from the United Church of God. Some were asked to leave, so they say. Some were told to get lost, you might say. You know, you're fired. And a few disagreed, and they wanted to appeal. They did, and we handled that. And it went on for months. And finally, one said, even if I win the appeal, I don't want to be a part of you any longer. And all of them that had appealed dropped their appeal. And shortly after that, they were elsewhere. But even so, it helped all of us to think definitively, does this man have a right? Is he accurate in what he is saying? If so, United needs to swallow a little crow and admit they made a mistake. If not, he has no leg to stand on. But they resigned, or they stopped. They didn't want to continue the appeal. So as I said, these three has helped me a lot in learning to think critically, all different ways to look at it, to analyze it in the light of the rules of the game, and to make a decision for their good, not just to show how strong we are, but truth. And it has helped me a lot in that respect, in learning how to focus, or shall we say, to learn how to meditate, to think definitively. It is true that sometimes we don't have time in our daily schedule to think. It is true in this rushed society that so many things are thrown at us all the time, and we don't even get through the last one before we hit with another one. And we're stuck. We're behind. As some have said, I can't keep up. I can't keep up with what they've asked me to do, because there's something always coming right over the horizon that's taking the time away. Well, that's true of 6 days of the week, but in a sense, it shouldn't be that way on the Sabbath. God has given us the Sabbath for a wonderful reason. Maybe we're using it properly, maybe we're not. The Sabbath is a good time for this critical thinking time, because the Sabbath is called a day of rest, and it's also called a day of refreshing. You know, as I said, if you've been mowing the grass and it's 100 degrees outside and you're sweating all over yourself, you come in, sit down, and have a cold beer. How refreshing. Or you come in and your wife has cooked a nice something. And the first taste, that's divine. And you are refreshed by that. There are a lot of things in our life that refresh us. And we feel different. We feel good. That's what the Sabbath was given to us for rest and refreshing. But sometimes it seems that we are so busy in the Church of God on the Sabbath that we don't have time to think, because all these things are thrown at us. I mentioned to you one of the churches that I pastored in the last few years. 10 years, 20 years, whatever. Big church. And when I got there, they told me, some of them hated to go to church on the Sabbath. I said, why? Well, we've got so many meetings. We have to do so many things. I have to go home to rest. Which was true. The pastor believed that if you keep them busy, even with inconsequential details, they don't have time to do whatever. He didn't last long either. The Sabbath is given to us for critical thinking times. Where did we come from? Where are we going? Is there a God? What about the kingdom of God? Is it the best kingdom? Or are there others that beat the kingdom of God? It was given to us as a day of rest. Now, there is a verse that said it was made for man, not the Sabbath made. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And you can take that out of context and say, yeah, you can do anything you want to, because it was made for us. It's ours. We do what we want to do. Well, it was made for us that we can rest and be refreshed, worship and adore God and idolize God and serve God on that day, and God's people too. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do anything, no. But it is a day when we can take time, make time to be alone with God, or to be alone with our family, or to be alone with ourselves, or to have time to think, because we got this week coming up And it's not going to be a good one. It'll be a tough one. So we need to be prepared by having our minds straight about it. But again, many people use the excuse that they're so busy they don't have the time for meditation, even on the Sabbath. And that may be true. I mean, this last 2 years, those in the ministry have been traveling 100, 200, almost 300 miles, certain things, and helping out, filling in on the Sabbath, which is not exactly the best way to keep the Sabbath, but it's better than having to slaughter bullocks every Sabbath all day long, I would think. I'd get that wouldn't be very restful either. But the point I'm trying to make is that the Sabbath is called a day of rest. Downtime. Downtime. You mechanics, you workers, certain ones, you know what downtime is. Unfortunately, our lifestyle habits sometimes rob us of the time we need for spending time in meditation or critical thinking or downtime. But we all need time alone, and I emphasize the word alone. Yes, we need fellowship. We do. We need to eat out and be with people. Yes, we do. But we also need time alone to be with God. We're not alone alone, but we are alone with God, and we need that time. I read the story of a man back in the early 1900s who was an inventor, I believe. He had 250 inventions in his life, and it was said that he sat for ideas for making money in doing that. His name was Dr. Elmer Gates of Chevy Chase, Maryland, and in his life he had 250 inventions, and he said that he sat for those ideas. Napoleon Hill met him in the early 1900s, and in those early years of the man sitting to find the answers to become successful, Napoleon Hill was sent to, or when he heard of him, realized, I want to meet this man, and I want to find out why he sits for ideas. And so he went to the man's office, and the secretary said, well, I'm sorry, you can't meet him today. He's not available. He is now sitting for ideas, and he will not be available to talk with you for 3 hours, which is a long time to sit for ideas. Napoleon Hill said, I'm going to wait on this one. I got to see this. He did. 3 hours later, Gates came in to his office, and the secretary said, you have Napoleon Hill wants to see you. And Hill told him who he was and what he wanted, and Gates explained that, yeah, that's true. He said, would you like to see where I sit? He said, yes, I would. I'd like to see that. So the man took him there. He took him to his place of sitting. It was a 12-foot by 12-foot room, well insulated, had in it a table, pencils, paper, and a light that he could turn on or off if he wanted to, whichever. And Gates sat at the table and gave his mind to the point at hand, until the answer came. Now, that has certain overtones of something that could be sinister. You say, well, that's demonism. Could be, if you give your mind over to it. But sitting there and thinking until you get an answer is common sense and good sense to think it through. Well, that overwhelmed Napoleon Hill. He'd never heard that before. So he plagiarized it and put it in his book and made money telling people about it. We don't all have an insulated room, but we can be alone. At Ambassador College in Pasadena, they had prayer closets. It was about this big, I guess, cube, 6 feet tall. Wasn't a lot of extra space in there for me, but it was a prayer closet where you could go and be alone because one year in the dorm that I was in, there were eight men in one room. There was no place of quietness. There was no place to be alone. There was no place to prayer. None of us were going to get out there in the middle of the room and pray out loud in front of the other seven men. So we had prayer closets where you could be alone and quiet. Even if you didn't talk to God, you could be there in quietness and think without being disrupted. Many men have become great because they used their minds to think through the problem until they found a successful solution. You will find an example of one of the faithful men of faith did that. Let's look in Genesis 24, verse 61. It's the story of Isaac. Isaac didn't have anything to do with what happened to him, but he was the son of faith. Promise. God promised Abraham a son, and Abraham remained faithful, and so did his wife, and a son was born to the people of faith, and they called his name Isaac. Isaac was now, I think, 40 years old, and he didn't have a wife. Some people today would think, awful, 40 and he's not married? What's wrong with that man? Nothing wrong in being 40 and not married. Better than marrying at 20 and get divorced. In verse 61 of Genesis 24, you will find that the servant of Abraham who had gone to find Isaac a wife, and God honored Abraham's request and the trip of the servant, you'll find in chapter 24 it says this. The servant was now coming back with the son's new wife. And it says in verse 61, just telling the story of the trip, Rebekah, the new wife, and her maids arose. They rode on the camels and followed the man. Then verse 62, Isaac back at home waiting for his wife. Apparently he had total faith. And he had faith in God, and he had faith in the servants. And, you know, we were told an ambassador in looking for a wife or a husband, date widely. And some men would say, hey, I'm widely. Date me. Isaac didn't date widely. He may not have dated at all. But he had faith in his father and mother, and he had faith in God, and God gave him a wonderful wife. Isaac came from the way of the Beer Leharoi place, for he dwelt in the south. And Isaac went out to twiddle his thumbs in the woods. No, Isaac went out to think. I don't know what he was thinking about. Did he think, I must be a fool. I'm letting this happen. I should have gone myself. Or was he thinking, what's she going to be like? What's God going to give me? I know it's going to be good, but I haven't seen it yet. But I have faith in it. Isaac went out to meditate or to think definitively in the field in the evening. He waited till there was time, the evening, when he was alone. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo and behold, there was a line of camels coming. Rebekah saw him, and she dismounted from the camel. And then you know the rest of the story. But Isaac was the second in the line of three. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we call them the fathers of the faithful. Isaac used meditation. That is, Isaac was the thinking man. He was a quiet man. But a quiet man can be very much a thinking man also. And Isaac was thinking. Didn't say what, but it said he was. maybe being a bachelor at 40, he was thinking, how do you treat a woman? What do you say to them? What do you do? Who knows? All it says was he was thinking about it. We are encouraged to think, and to think definitively. You'll find in Philippians 4, verse 8, again, a list is given of things to think about. And if you took, and I think there are 8 or 9, I've forgotten how many are here, but if you took one and thought about it for a week or two, maybe 3 weeks, think about it, track it, shall we say, who knows how much you could incorporate in your life and make a big difference in assessing or meditating or thinking definitively. Philippians chapter 4 and chapter 4 and verse 8. Paul said to those in Philippi, finally, we're getting to the point, he said, whatever things are true. Now that's something to think about. How to be a man of truth or a woman of truth. Whatever things are noble. Now we read of the nobility in England as having a bash in the nude. Harry, is it? Showing off the hair on his chest, I guess. Not very noble, though. But whatever things are noble. Noble is supposed to imply a man of integrity, of dignity, of truth, and all of those things. Whatever things are just. You know, not whatever you can get away with. Whatever things are pure, that is wholesome, not vulgar. Whatever things are lovely, not ugly and grotesque. Whatever things are of good report. If there's any virtue in these things, notice it says in the King James, in the old King James it says think. In this one it says meditate on these things. Meditate. Think definitively. How can I be noble? How can I be just? How can I have a pure mind? How can I think of things as lovely? How can I do a good report? If it's praiseworthy. You've heard me say we become what we put in our mind. So if we're going to be like God, maybe we should think like God, think definitively of how to be like God. Then there's one other, and this was spoken to a young minister who was somewhat naive, or at least without experience. And you will find in 1 Timothy 4, verse 16, Paul, the old battle-scarred veteran, was advising Timothy on how to conduct himself. And he said this to him in verse 16, take heed to yourself. Now, Timothy could have said, what do you mean? I've been a minister, I'm a pastor, I'm an evangelist. Don't tell me about taking heed to myself. I know. I'm not dumb. But Paul said, take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. Continue in them, for doing this you will save yourself and those who hear you. Doctrine is a list of principles by which we live. And in verse 15, he said, meditate on these things. The doctrines that we teach, the principles that we teach, the things that make us like God. And he said, give yourself entirely to them. It's not just a part-time thing that we do occasionally on the Sabbath, but it's our whole life. And he said, do it that way so that your progress may be evident to all. You know, if you're overweight and you've lost weight, someone comes up and says, hey, you know, you've lost weight. You look good. That pleases us. But how many people come up and say, hey, I can tell you're growing. You're not the man you used to be. You're different. And it's good. That should be that way with all of us. He said, meditate on these things. Schweitzer was asked, "What's wrong with men?" He thought about it for a while and he said, "Men simply don't think." But some men's mouths and minds are running nonstop. They're thinking, but not as they ought to think. I find sometimes, like I lie in bed and I can't go to sleep, 1,000 things are running through my mind, and I find it very hard to bring it back to one point. And it'll go on that way for an hour, that I'm running ideas through the mind, but it's nothing definitive because I can't sleep. It is true that sometimes we are so frustrated with the schedule of life, day after day after day, that indeed we do not have time for focused thinking. That's true. But we're urged in the Bible to make time, to pencil in time, to determine, what is my goal? What is my problem? What do I need to do? How should I do it? And write down all the ideas we can think of that would help that out. Meditation is not the mantra of a guru who's half crazy. Meditation is focused thinking, definitive thinking on a very particular subject. It brings about that aha time in our life when we finally see it and it hits us right in the face. Then we begin to grow in the gracious ways of God our Father and our older brother Jesus Christ. I know you're acquainted with the word meditate, and I know you do meditate, but I wanted to remind us all a little more firmly of what is called definitive thinking or meditation in that way, thinking of a definite point from all different ways of looking at it in order to change things that are not going well in our life and to give us a better life.